Hello, Candy Matson.
I understand you've been hired to find out who knocked off Donna Dunham.
Abrupt and right to the point. That's my business, old man who talks like a ghost.
Take care of your health, little lady. Donna Dunham is dead. Let her stay like that.
You take care of your cues and I'll show my peas, understood?
Not quite. Listen to this.
Oh, goody, goody. Bullets now delivered by phone. Thanks for the slug. I'll have it identified later.
Maybe you'll be identified later. Remember what I said, Candy Matson. Forget about Donna Dunham.
Well, that is Candy Matson, as you may have guessed, and she was a prominent radio detective of the 1940s. But she came some 100 years after the beginning of what's generally considered to be modern detective fiction. And how long have women played a part in it? Not just fiction, but fact. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. Guiding us through 175 years of lady detectives in fact and fiction is Erica Janik. She's the executive producer of Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Radio and also a historian. And welcome to University of the Air, Erica.
Thank you so much for having me.
If we go back to the 1840s, the first name that comes to mind in terms of detective fiction has to be Edgar Allan Poe.
Absolutely.
Is that legit?
It is legit. Edgar Allan Poe wrote what is generally considered the first modern detective story. It was a short story. He actually ended up writing three of these short stories. He didn't consider them detective stories, though. He actually called them romantic terror. but they definitely had a detective figure in them. And that is something that is new for that time period. You find stories, of course, of mystery going back for centuries. And women had actually been writing kind of the predecessors to detective fiction for long before Poe wrote these stories. Gothic novels in
sure.
the 18th century, you know, they have that dark and foreboding setting, and there's usually some crime that happened. You find that also in sensation novels in the 19th century. And some of the most prominent figures in those types of writing are women, Anne Radcliffe, Mary Elizabeth Braddon. So they're very prominent women that are kind of setting the scene, that are writing these kind of dark crime stories. But what makes Poe's story different is this detective figure, in that in some of these other stories, they have a kind of pseudo-detective who is involved in solving this crime because they're trying to avenge the name of someone who has been wronged in their family. They have a personal stake in whatever has happened. Maybe a father, a brother, a sister was killed, and they want to find who the killer is.
So personal rather than an official relationship to the crime.
Exactly. So what's different with the detective is that the detective is disinterested. They're not connected to that crime. And this isn't the only case that they solve. You know, they come in, they solve this case, and then they go on to solve other cases. Whereas in these stories that predated Poe's detective story, when that pseudo-detective kind of figures out the crime, well, then their detecting career is over. So Poe writes these stories in the 1840s. He actually based his second story on an actual crime case because one of the criticisms of his first story was that what's really that challenging about solving a crime that you made up?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it's a good point. And so Poe took that criticism seriously and he thought, well, fine, I'm going to write about a real case and offer my own solution through that story.
It hadn't been solved.
It had not been solved. And so he, you know, looked at all the available evidence and created kind of a fictionalized version of it in which he offered his own solution. And then in the third story he ends up writing, it's kind of the first case of armchair detection, in that the detective figure basically just reads the newspaper and comes up with a solution to the crime based on what they read in the newspaper.
Kind of inductive reasoning based on secondhand facts.
Exactly. So Poe writes these stories and they don't actually make any big waves. You know, he doesn't inspire a rash of imitators mm-hmm. in detective fiction. You don't really find the detective genre really taking off until the 1860s, 1870s. These are the only real detective stories that Poe wrote. Actually, the first novel-length detective story in the English language was written by a woman in the 1860s.
It's interesting that we have this mushrooming of interest in this in the 1860s. I don't know if it had to do with improved technology or what exactly, or the, sort of a more urbanized environment?
I think it's a combination of both things. I think you find in the 19th century is really when cities start instituting city police forces. Before that time, law enforcement was kind of on a community level. You maybe had a constable, but otherwise kind of neighborhood watch type things. But as cities are growing larger, that neighborhood watch isn't really sufficient for actually keeping order in cities. And so London creates a city police force, and then towns all over the United States start creating city police forces. And very soon after that is when you start to see the fictionalization of these, because it seems something that would make for a great story. Obviously, crime is very popular. And then I think it's also technology. People are really looking at science as kind of ascendant. There's all kinds of new technology in the 19th century, and people are really interested in seeing how science can be applied to their life, how it might help them figure out things that they weren't able to figure out before. And so I think you find that's part of the interest in detective stories, too, is that the detective, you know, uses all of this logical, rational thinking, but also there's some kind of scientific analysis,
right.
Though some of it's a little bit pseudoscience.
But, you know, today in particular, right. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, you definitely find some of those early detectives who are phrenologizing people,
yes.
Or are using mesmerism to solve their case. But that was considered science of a sort at the time. And so I think that's part of the appeal of it, too, is that there's this mystery that new technology can help us figure out.
There's even a Sherlock Holmes story. Of course, this would be later, 25 years or so, in which Sherlock Holmes concludes that a man must be particularly intelligent because of the size of his head.
Absolutely.
not taking into account the actual content of it. Interest also arises in interest if you read the poetry of Robert Browning at about this time in Abnormal Psychology, right?
Absolutely. People are definitely trying to figure out what it is that causes someone to go bad, I guess. And there's all kinds of theories about why people commit crimes and how they end up in prisons. You find kind of the rise of criminology, and some of it, again, I think we would consider pseudoscience today. And you know, because there were very different views about women versus men. There was the thought that a woman who had committed a crime had basically was not redeemable at all. You know, a man could have done something wrong and he would serve his time and then he could become a respectable member of society. But a woman? No, once she committed a crime, she was bad forever. And this is a view that really starts to change in the 19th century. But these are, you know, some of these early theories about, you know, what happens to people and what happens when they commit a crime and whether it's possible to fix that.
One thing that seems to set detective fiction aside from other fiction is that perfectly respectable people, including little old ladies, very proper people with proper lives, can get fascinated in, engrossed in horrific crimes because there's this intellectual element to it. To solving the crime.
Absolutely. I think you're definitely right. You know, one of the things that you find particularly in a lot of the older 19th century detective stories is that, you know, the crime has usually already happened. So they're not terribly gory. Often some of these stories,
you don't actually see the violence happen.
You don't see it at all. You know, they don't even use the word blood often, you know. And, you know, there must be some. But, yeah, definitely the fact that it is this kind of rational problem solving makes it okay for – well, kind of okay – for an older woman to be involved in this or a young woman. I mean, there's still a lot of hesitation about whether this is a suitable profession for a woman to be engaged in. I mean, one of the things that makes it okay for an older woman to be involved in this is because she doesn't have a husband or children to take care of.
She's not shirking responsibility otherwise.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are some stereotypes about older women that they're gossipy and nosy. And these are all good skills for detecting. And so, you know, that they're kind of collecting clues by hanging out around town and listening to what people are talking about.
Maybe also less likely to get romantically entangled with a suspect or even a fellow crime solver.
That's definitely true. That love interest is kind of taken out of the story. I mean, you know, you find that marriage plot that kind of is in so much fiction. That's not really the case in these detective stories. And I think actually that's one of the things that's made them really popular throughout time is that women have, particularly for women in these stories, is that women have an object in life that isn't just getting married. It's using their brain to solve a case and to be clever and to be respected for being logical. And so I think with these older women, you know, they're basically considered beyond hope. They're never going to get married. And so there's no need to have that kind of romantic banter or anything. That's definitely different with the younger, with the girl detectives that come a little bit later. But definitely with these older women, it's really all about the crimes, and they definitely have longer detecting careers.
Well, let's get into the 1860s then, when this really started to take off, and look first at detectives in particular before we get into the whole police force phenomenon, and look at some of the female detectives. At what point do we actually find that word being used?
You start to see the word detective appearing in about the 1850s. I mean, it's around kind of in the 1840s as well, but it starts to become a role that people might recognize in the 1850s. And one of the people that really popularizes the idea of a detective is Alan Pinkerton. And he moved to Chicago from Scotland. He'd been in a little political trouble. We'll just leave it at that. And he moves to Chicago, and he works for the Chicago police force for a while, but figures out that this isn't really what he wants to be doing. And so he sets up his own private detective agency in Chicago. And he actually hires the first known female private eye. There's a young woman. Her name is Kate Warren. And she just appears at his door one day in the mid-1850s and says she'd like a job. And he at first thinks that she's asking to be a secretary. And she says, no, no, I want to be a detective. And he's a little bit taken aback because there are no female detectives, and he certainly doesn't have any on his force. But he agrees to listen to her. And one of the things that she says that really sells herself to him is that she says, I am a woman, and I can get things out of people that you can't because you're a man.
Men and women?
Men and women. She really sells herself, though, as getting it out of women. But it is definitely true. She can get things out of men as well. But that's definitely one of the things that I think Pinkerton takes a chance on her because, you know, he is interested in building his business. It is still kind of getting started at that point. And so he takes her on, and it seems as though he never really regrets it. The main thing that Pinkerton is really involved in is kind of business cases. A lot of businesses thought that people were, their employees usually, were stealing money from them. And so he was hired to kind of investigate and find out where these leakages were happening. And so Kate Warren becomes very involved in this early on. And what she basically does is go undercover and often cozies up to the wife of the main suspect. They become good friends. And then lo and behold, that woman reveals what her husband has been up to, or where the money's hidden, or what's really going on. And so she quickly makes a name for herself. She's very good at going undercover, very good at winning people's trust and their confidence. And I think one of the biggest cases that she's involved in is actually has to do with President Abraham Lincoln. There had been rumors that there was an assassination attempt planned for when he was on his way to Washington to take office. And Pinkerton had heard about this. And so he and Kate Warren basically went undercover. And she dressed as a fine Southern lady and hung out with a lot of Confederates and gathered enough information to know that, yes, it really did seem like there was going to be an assassination attempt. And so she and Pinkerton came up with a plan to get Abraham Lincoln safely to Washington, D.C.
In disguise.
In disguise. So she dressed Lincoln up as her invalid brother, and they rode on the train together from Philadelphia to D.C. And obviously he made it.
Remarkable story. It's almost hard to picture
exactly
that combination.
It is. It's actually on her. She's buried in Graceland Cemetery in Chicago, and on her gravestone, it makes mention of the Abraham Lincoln story, as does on the – she's buried in kind of a Pinkerton plot, and there's another agent right next to her, which he was also involved a little bit in foiling this. But, you know, it's clearly the big thing with her.
Well, we know that during the Civil War, espionage was a big part. It seemed to be more a matter of Southerners than Northerners, but maybe that's just because of the documentation. But in that kind of relationship between espionage and detective work is closely allied, and it would be a natural for a woman to slide from one to the other.
Definitely. I think you really find, particularly with these private detective agencies, that the lines between espionage and detecting are murky at best, if they're not. Private detection was really involved in kind of doing interstate business. You know, these city police forces had just formed, and they really were struggling to actually maintain law and order over a city. And so private detectives would kind of fill in. And a lot of that was some kind of spy work. And one of the things that women have done, you know, since Kate Warren all the way up to the present day in both fact and fiction is going undercover and doing it very well. And so it does kind of make it natural. And I think some of it is that no one really expected a woman to be acting as a detective. And so, you know, she didn't cut a suspicious figure because they're like, well, she's just another woman in there. She's not doing anything. And so she was very effective, both during the Civil War, and that definitely continues with other female detectives.
So do we see then a burgeoning at the same time of fiction about female detectives? Are we getting to the 1860s and years following?
You definitely start to see more. Burgeoning, maybe not quite yet, but it's funny. In 1864, the first two female detectives, fictional female detectives, come out. They're both by British writers. One's named Mrs. Paschal and one is named Mrs. Gladden. And they both work for the London police force decades before London would actually have any women on its force. But they're very competent. No one's really quite sure why the writers decided to create female detectives. In some ways, it's been suggested that they might have just done it as a way to get attention because there weren't any female detectives. And so this is what sets our book apart.
Plead the cause.
Uh-huh. Exactly. Yeah. So they're really fascinating figures, though. Mrs. Paschal is perhaps more interesting than Mrs. Gladden. She's very feisty. They're both very good at their jobs, but there's one case where she's actually chasing after a female suspect. And that female suspect kind of goes through a hole, and Mrs. Paschal, she's dressed very properly in her stiff crinoline. She can't get in there, so she takes it off and and then slides through the hole and keeps running. And, you know, there's other cases where people are saying, like, you're what? You're a detective? Like, they have those? And she's like, if I wasn't good at my job, they wouldn't keep me. And, you know, she's just very matter of fact about it. And so it's nice to see that these early female detectives are very competent, because you don't always find that. Later on, you definitely find some stories where the women always need to be saved by the men.
There's a little bit of that. And even in the Candy Matson series that we began with, occasionally, one will end with her in a fix that only a man can get her out of.
Absolutely. You know, I think that that does come back again and again, unfortunately. I think it's getting better. But I think you find from the very beginning, there have been these very competent women like Mrs. Paschal and Mrs. Gladden. 1864 is also the year that that first full-length detective novel comes out, written by a woman. Her name was Meta Victor. She was writing under a pen name, Seeley Register. And her detective story is called The Dead Letter. It had a male detective in it, but it was a good seller. It wasn't a dime novel. It was actually a hardcover book that they put out, and it sold very well. She wrote all kinds of books. Detective fiction was really only one of the many types of things that she wrote. But 1864 is kind of a big year for women in detection, with these two fictional female detectives appearing as well as this novel.
Comes out in the United States. At what point, though? What point do we start to see American female detectives?
Well, the big one that comes is a woman named Anna Catherine Green, and that's in the 1870s. And she is actually so well known in the 19th century that she gets the title the mother of detective fiction. And I think it's funny because, you know, so many of us have probably never heard of this woman before. But Arthur Conan Doyle actually wrote her a fan letter. That's how famous she was. He was interested in coming to meet her and finding out how she did what she did. And so she published her first book in 1878. She had not really set out to be a detective writer. She really wanted to be a poet. And she had tried for a number of years to get her poems published. Emerson had actually come to visit her college. She was one of the few women of her generation to go to college. She went to Ripley College in Vermont. And she shared some of her poems with him. And he said, well, these are very nice, but I don't know if you have a poetry career in front of you. So she went after college, she went back to live with her father, and she spent about 6 years working on this detective story. And she really hoped that if she could get this detective story published, that would get her name out there, and then she could write poems. But
that's, you know, I mean, Conan Doyle had the same kind of attitude toward Sherlock Holmes is that, you know, really it's overshadowing better stuff, you know, novels that I've written, which today very, very few people have heard of.
Yeah, I think it's kind of funny that the things that we remember some of these people for the most are the things that they kind of wished we didn't remember them for.
Yeah, well, yeah, yeah. She was successful then with the detective genre.
She was very successful. She actually had basically an overnight bestseller. It ended up selling about 10 million copies.
That's phenomenal for, what, 1874?
1878. 78? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And read all over the place. She had fans both in the United States and in Europe. You know, Agatha Christie recalled later, she in her memoir, reading Anna Katharine Green when she was a kid. So she was very popular. She really hit it big with this Leavenworth case. And she basically never wrote poetry again. She ended up writing dozens more books, and none were quite as successful as that first one, but she definitely kind of laid the groundwork for the detective fiction that came later.
Today, we have these various pigeonholes genres. You know, we have the cozy, and we have all these other kind of, I suppose the political one, the procedural, and all these other niches.
Yep.
What kind of niche would these early ones fill, if any?
I would say they probably are in that cozy.
Uh-huh. Nobody gets hurt too violently and no sex.
Absolutely. That is absolutely right. So it's a locked, her first book there, The Leavenworth Case, is a locked room mystery. So there's a dead body in a room. If you read the book now, I think you'll find it very predictable and a little bit cliched, but I think the thing to remember when reading it is that she actually wrote all of these first.
You know, and that's true. I mean, if you want to even talk about Raymond Chandler, it's like if you go and read, you know, The Long Goodbye or something, wait a minute, that's a cliche, the detective going to visit the millionaire client, but that's where it came from.
Yeah, so in that first book, she has a suspicious butler. He didn't do it. She has a schematic of that room. She has scientific analysis. Even that locked room idea is something that was pretty new at the time. And so she kind of is laying the groundwork that lots of people will copy later on. And she had grown up her father was a judge. And so she was pretty familiar with the legal system and police work. And she actually was, her books were so convincing that there's actually a Pennsylvania legislator who argued that this book could not have been written by a woman because no woman would know as much as she did.
Yeah, sort of backward way of approaching the thing. But then it would fall a little bit into the procedural category to know that much about the process of detection and perhaps even conviction too. As we get into then the 1870s, what else develops in terms of detective fiction and detective fact?
So we have Anna Katharine Green writing these stories. You find definitely a few more women writing detective stories, as well as men writing female detectives.
Oh, really?
Mostly in dime novels is where you find them. There's the Denver Doll. She's about 18 years old, and she's always, you know, bursting in, guns blazing. She's actually a girl detective in a way. She's 18 years old. But unlike a lot of those girl detectives, she manages to make it through her book without getting married. That's something that happens to a lot of these girl detectives. They can detect, and then they get married, and then their career is over. So there's a lot of dime novel female detectives in the 1880s. In the 1890s, you start to see another professional female detective. That's a new thing, too. Anna Katharine Green writes some female detectives, but most of them are amateurs until the 20th century. But Loveday Brooke is a professional female detective. She was created in 1893. She's very competent, works for a private detective agency. And so this is going on in the fictional world. And it's around the same time, too, that you start to see cities are actually hiring women to join their police force. It had been a long, long, long fight. And no city really hired women because they wanted to. They were pressured by women's groups and reformers for decades, and often only gave in after, you know, letter writing campaigns and petitions. And often groups like the Women's Christian Temperance Union would actually fund this position. They would offer to pay the salary of a female police officer if they would just take them on.
And they were interested in this cause because they thought that the abuses of women in prison, I mean, just the neglect, not even necessarily the abuse, was not solving the problem of you know, women forced into crime or women inclined toward it, for that matter, that that there was no way that a male prison keeper could be sympathetic enough,
yes,
or understanding enough, let's say, even insightful enough with a female prisoner to come up with any kind of progress.
Absolutely. Yeah. So female reformers are visiting prisons starting in about the 1820s. I mean, there's groups that are visiting them even in the 18th century, long before that, but more concerted efforts really in the 1820s, 1830s. And it's on these visits to these prisons that they're starting to see the conditions that female inmates are living in. These prisons are not really built to house men and women. So women are often kept in cells with other men. You find frequent notices in the newspaper of pregnancies in the prison. If women are kept in a separate place, it's often, you know, there's 50 of them jammed in a room that's actually supposed to be for six. And a lot of the guards, you know, they just don't want to deal with them. And so the women are dirty. They're often hungry. They might be abused. They might not.
But diseased.
Diseased, absolutely. You know, prison conditions for both men and women are pretty terrible. But women really are like, we really need a woman in here to help protect them and to make sure that they're getting to court and making sure that they're being taken seriously. And so they start really advocating to have what they call prison matrons. And so women start moving into prison work in the 1840s, 1850s. And once they get in there, that's really when they decide, well, actually, we need to be more on the front line. We need to be a part of that first interaction, too, on the street, in the jailhouse, before women even end up in prison. And so that's what really starts that drive toward having female police officers.
Well, let's follow some of those female police officers in fiction and in fact when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Erica Janik. We're looking at 175 years of lady detectives in fact and fiction. In fact, Pistols and Petticoats is the name of her book with that subtitle. And before we get onto the promised topic of police women, fictional and real, I wanted to finish up a little bit with the detectives and follow them into the 20th century. Again, both the fictional and real ones, but we're starting to see women detectives in real life, whether they're, you know, just prison matrons is one thing, but they're actually, as you say, Erica, going on the front lines now and getting involved in apprehensions that lead to incarcerations. And we see kind of parallel development in fact and fiction as we get into the turn of the 20th century.
You do start to see kind of parallel development. So as women are joining the police force, the role that they're really arguing for and why they should be on it, besides this protection of women in jail, is that they really want to protect women and children out in the world. And so they kind of take on this detecting role as well as a protection role, because one of the things that they do is that they return runaway children to their home. So a parent reports that a child is missing and police women will track them down. And you find cases of, you know, a child ran away from their home in New York and ended up somehow in Florida, and the policewoman managed to find that child and return it to her family, you know, in the early 20th century. This isn't like as easy, I think, as, you know, I'm like, what technology did they use in order to do that? They're also busting fortune teller rings. That's a really big one, is that there's, you know, there's all of these fake hucksters.
Yeah, fake seances and that kind of thing.
Exactly. And so women go undercover and will visit these people over and over again, trying to collect all the evidence they need to break it up. And another thing that women are really involved in is there's a lot of fear about prostitution,
sure,
what they call white slavery. And so they're really trying to track down the people, the men that are preying on these young girls. And so you find these early female police officers working in a detective role in a way of, you know, they're waiting at the boat dock as immigrants are coming, and they're watching out for young women that are by themselves and seeing, you know, making sure that some unscrupulous man doesn't come over and put them in a perilous situation.
Not always as easy as it looked. I mean, even in the context of the people they were working with or for, you mentioned the case of two teenage girls who run away from home. They disguise themselves as boys.
Yep.
And they do get picked up by a couple of men who claim to be their fathers.
That's right. Yeah. So they get picked up at the train station. They do eventually, their fathers had reported them missing. And so these girls were tracked down and brought to the police station. But there is always kind of this jurisdiction fight over whether these children belong to the women or whether they belong to the male officers. And so this actually leads to this big court case. The main female officer is actually charged with insubordination because the fathers come to the police station and say, I want my daughters back. And she says, I'm not sure who you are. Like, I need to investigate that you are who you say you are before I give these girls back. They're about 13 years old. And the police chief is just like, no, the men say that they're their father and we're just going to give them back. And she refuses. And it takes a couple of hours and she finally confirms their identity and hands the daughters over. But it does lead to this kind of court case where she is tried. She does eventually win in a way, though she is kind of slapped on the wrist and said, you know, you need to listen to the people that are in charge. But she really saw herself as doing her job, that her job was to protect women and children. And that's what she was doing. She wasn't just going to hand over a woman to a man who claimed to have some kind of relation to her. These police women were really on the sides of the young women who came in and often in their to their peril in a way, because, you know, they often got a lot of trouble with their superiors because even runaways, you know, who might end up somehow in their station house, they wouldn't necessarily just hand them back over to the parent. You know, they wanted to know, what caused you to run away?
Right.
Like, what's going on at home? Like, do we really want to send this young person back to that situation? So it was really kind of a social work role. They were really trying to figure out why someone ended up in this situation and whether it was actually right to send them back out into it.
I suppose they might investigate families often then, I mean, because domestic disputes do play a large part. Hard in police work.
Absolutely. They were definitely investigating families. And that's one of the things that led to some opposition to actually hiring more female officers. You know, a lot of people thought it was a good idea to have women on the force until the women came knocking on their door. And then they didn't think it was so great an idea to have female officers who were, you know, kind of checking out the situations for these children in the community. But yes, it did happen a lot that a lot of the work that they were involved in was kind of a mothering role. That's one of the ways that they talked about themselves, even. They said that they were mothers with badges and that they were mothering on the street. And they even really looked like mothers, too, because police women didn't actually have a standard uniform until late in the 20th century. They weren't given weapons. Some of them didn't even have a badge. And if they did, they usually just stuffed it in their bag. So they just looked like a normal person on the street. And that's partly what they wanted. You know, they didn't want to scare people off. They thought a person in a uniform was kind of intimidating. But if you were just kind of a motherly figure walking around offering to help someone, but you also have these skills, these social work skills, these detecting skills, that was really valuable.
Now, that all sounds, although very productive and very valuable, rather humdrum, in fact. But what do we find in fiction then as these developments are taking place?
That's absolutely true. They do kind of create this kind of box for themselves, these early women. You definitely do find some real women that do break out of that and do more flamboyant, more high-profile cases. But definitely women on the page are involved in more, I don't know, I think more of the types of cases that we'd be more familiar with. Those are the people that are solving murders, you know, involved in thefts and burglaries. So definitely more high profile cases than police, these early police women probably ever really saw. There might be an occasional incidence of this. But by the early 20th century, you start to see more of these girl detectives that I mentioned. besides that Denver doll in the dime novel, she's just one of many. But that Anna Katharine Green, the mother of detective fiction in the 19th century, she creates a young female detective. Her name is Violet Strange. It's a great name.
Yeah.
And she's a lot, I think, in common with Nancy Drew in a way.
I was wondering when her name would come up.
I know. We made it this far. Uh-huh. So Violet Strange is actually predates Nancy Drew by about 2 decades. But she lost her mother at a young age. She has a kind of a permissive father that lets her do whatever she wants. She's done with school, so she doesn't need to worry about that, just like Nancy. Violet works for a private detective agency. She's upper class, and so a lot of the cases that she's involved in are among high society.
Which makes for some great reading, of course.
Absolutely, it does. And no one, you know, she has no trouble getting in certain places because she's among that social set anyway. So, you know, one of her first cases, she's at an opera house, and of course she's there because she would be there anyway. And, you know, sometimes she travels to her cases in a limousine. And she's often wearing furs and a silk dress. And, you know, no one thinks that she's a detective, but she's very competent, always gets her man, and it is usually a man. She's often helping other women. That's one of the things that a lot of these detective stories you find by the early 20th century, if they have a female detective, often the person that they're helping is another woman like themselves. And they really see it as kind of a personal crusade to help other women.
So you have the amateur detective, yep, like Nancy Drew, but then you also have the professional detective, private detective, and police detectives all kind of going at the same time.
Absolutely. So you start to find there are more professional female detectives appearing by the 20th century, but that certainly hasn't put the amateur sleuth out of business. You know, there's lots of spinsters that are on the job. Another spinster that's amateur role solving detective stories is Amelia Butterworth. She, like Miss Marple, often is witness to things out her window or while she's out, you know, doing her older woman activities like knitting and gardening and birding. And, you know, you find a lot of these spinsters have very similar hobbies. I like those hobbies too, so I'm right there with them. And so you find both these amateur sleuths and these professional sleuths. You start to find more women working on police forces in fiction starting in about the 1940s, 1950s. They're far fewer before then. That's kind of when the police procedural novel, there's certainly kind of procedural elements of some of these older stories, but it really kind of comes into its own in the 1950s, 1960s. And that kind of gives women a role because they're working as part of a team. And so you start to see more fictional women in these police stations.
What do you think is the appeal for a writer or a reader of an amateur detective?
I think something that's appealing about it is that I think it makes you feel like you could solve this crime too, that you might have those skills, that you don't have to have any kind of special training in order to do it, that if you can, you know, be logical and rational, you might be able to do it as well. I think that there's something about that kind of unexpected person who is very competent at solving crimes. I think there's something appealing about that as well. And is like over and over again is kind of funny in a way. I mean, I've read lots of Miss Marple and seen lots of the depictions of it. And, you know, it never ceases to make me happy to see this like elderly woman who doesn't really look like a detective, but is doing a great job.
And the emphasis there would be, in that particular case, in the cozies, that you can do this without violence.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that is definitely something that appeals. And, you know, that's something that Raymond Chandler complains about, is that these cozy stories don't have any real violence in them. And the way that he writes about it, it makes it seem like they don't know what violence is, the writers. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was actually a deliberate choice that, you know, particularly in the early 20th century, after going through World War I, people had seen enough violence. They really didn't want to read that. And so having, you know, we still like the puzzle. We still like that mystery. But maybe we don't need to have some kind of gratuitous violence as well. And so I think it was a really deliberate choice on the part of a lot of these writers that they just wanted to continue with this kind of nice resolution of a case. I mean, that's what's appealing about detective story, is that a wrong is righted, that you know where it's going to end up in that situation, that, you know, everything will be okay in the end. And so I think that's what these hard-boiled writers start kind of reacting against.
Sure.
But I don't think it's it's an either or situation. I think that there are really deliberate decisions that are being made by these writers.
Where do we start to see the husband and wife detective team, like Mr. and Mrs. North?
You start to see the husband and wife. I think it actually starts coming more in radio than it does in the fiction. You start to see these kind of husband-wife detecting teams on radio programs in the 30s. You also start to see it in the movies. I think because there's a nice interplay between the man and the woman, and that's part of what makes it appealing about them.
Yeah, it's a little bit of it's sort of the rise of the comedy detective genre.
Absolutely. Yeah, so, some of these earlier stories, they might have some funny elements to them, but there's not a lot of witty banter, we'll just say. But that's definitely something that becomes very popular in radio and movies in the 30s and 40s. And so I think that's really the rise of the male-female detecting duo. Though at the same time, in some of these older stories, even with the amateur detectives, the duo is often the amateur kind of in conflict with the professional.
Yes. Oh, sure. Yeah.
And so In some ways, you see that very early on, that they have this kind of friendly rivalry, usually friendly. I mean, it usually starts out with the detective being irritated that this woman is here. Then she proves herself in some way, and he kind of sighs, okay. And then sometimes eventually they start to work together. So I think that the husband-wife detecting duo is kind of, I don't know, just another level of that interplay.
Now, as we look at the 1930s and 40s, another element that you see in fiction, and I assume in great measure it's based on fact, is the detective who is at odds with conventional law enforcement. That goes right through Dirty Harry and on forward. Do we see women detectives who are in that position of being kind of having an antagonistic relationship with conventional police?
Yeah, you definitely see that in the fictional side as well. One of the first hard-boiled women, I guess, is a woman named Gail Gallagher, and she is a private detective, and people on the police force are not overly thrilled that she's around. There's one police officer that's okay with her, and they develop an okay relationship, but she really doesn't see herself as part of that. She's kind of solving her own cases. She doesn't really see a need to call for them, doesn't really need their help. And so I think you do find that pretty early on, that a lot of the women that are solving these cases, they're often treated bad by the male police force. And so they're not terribly interested in involving them in the case. And, even as I mentioned with those detecting duos, it's a similar thing in that the police force is usually irritated that person is out there. I don't know if it's to the same negative, sometimes violent degree that you sometimes see with some of the male detectives. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely an antagonistic relationship very early on. And I think that also plays out in reality between private detection and kind of official municipal detectives.
By the book.
Yep, exactly. The lines between them are a little blurry sometimes, and much to the irritation of both of them.
Well, let's look at some of these police women in fiction and fact when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Erica Janik. She's an historian and the author of Pistols and Petticoats, 175 Years of Lady Detectives in Fact and Fiction. And we're looking at this sometimes crisp dichotomy between fact and fiction in the way these detectives and women police are being represented. And I gather that not all of the real detectives approved of detective fiction.
That's absolutely true.
Say an understatement there.
Yeah, you find that very early on, and I think continuing up until the present day. I mean, Alan Pinkerton actually started writing his own stories down because he thought that detective writers were cheapening his profession. And so he thought that a real detective should be writing these stories. And then you find in the early 20th century, the first female homicide detective, her name was Mary Sullivan, and she was in New York City. And she was not overly fond of the way that detectives were portrayed in fiction as well. I can read you a little bit here. Sullivan had little patience with fictional detectives or their creators. She contended that fictional crimes were far too complex to be real. When one man sets out to kill another, he doesn't simply shoot him, she wrote. He lures him into a swimming pool that contains man-eating fish, or he arranges to have a medieval battle axe fly out of the wall when a spring is touched in a room some distance away. Every bit of planning provided more evidence and made the case easier, not harder to solve, she claimed. Sullivan was particularly exasperated by novels in which a brilliant amateur solves the case after the professionals have proved themselves to be incredibly stupid. In Sullivan's experience, she had never known a murder case to be taken over and solved by an unskilled amateur. Sullivan also objected to the bolt of inspiration that seemed to hit the fictional detective and lead to the solution to every case. Murder cases aren't broken by a series of brainwaves, Sullivan wrote. Their solving is often the result of patient drudgery that the inspiration boys wouldn't dream of following through. She goes on to comment that as there are more and more amateur sleuths appearing in these books, that she'll just be out in the world and women will just come up to her and say, "Hey, I'm really good at whatever. I would make a great police officer." She's like, we don't need you. Thanks.
Though, as we get into women police officers as opposed to women detectives, and they're out on the street, presumably, although sure not always, but often in dangerous situations. And now do they start to carry weapons?
Yeah, so you start to find women carrying weapons. It kind of varies by city. New York, the women start carrying weapons in about the 1930s. By the 1940s, 1950s, women in most major cities are carrying some kind of weapon, though they might not be carrying it regularly. They might not ever use it. So you really don't find women carrying a weapon all the time until the mid-20th century. And in part, a lot of police forces thought that women didn't need to have a weapon because they were just mothering, and mothering doesn't need a weapon. But by about the 1940s, 1950s, women are getting pretty fed up with this kind of boxed role that they admittedly argued for themselves, that they wanted to have this protective role to get in. But now they really want to be out on patrol. They really want to be out doing what male officers are doing. Another thing that they want is to get a promotion. A lot of women were not able to rise in the ranks. You were a policewoman and that was your rank forever. So they start basically suing for the opportunity to be more equal with men.
They actually institute court cases.
They do, because, you know, trying to get legislation, trying to argue for it isn't really working. And so there's a woman in New York, Felicia Spritzer. Excuse me, her name is hard to say. She actually sues to take the promotion exam to be a sergeant. And she is successful. And that opens up this exam to women that had been closed before. And she passes the test and becomes one of the first female sergeants in New York City. Even though this case kind of sets a precedent, women still have to kind of fight for these opportunities. They're helped by, you know, various civil rights acts that start appearing in the 1960s, 1970s that people are fighting for. A lot of these include provisions that make it easier for women to have equality on police forces. But it certainly isn't something that they won very easily at all.
So are they, under this premise, in no way different from male police officers? In terms of their role, in terms of what they're doing?
At this point, no. But that was definitely something that they had to fight for. They had to fight beyond that protective role that they had argued for. The first women actually go out on street patrol in the late 1960s, and they start to be paired with male partners. There's some women, though, that have a hard time finding a man who is willing to be their partner.
Now, that gets an interesting case, doesn't it? There's that famous case of the women, two women police officers.
Yeah, so there's two women in California, York and Kidder, and they had tried to find other partners, and no one would be partners with them. So they said, well, I guess we'll be partners. And they were the first female homicide detection team. And that's actually what the TV detectives Cagney and Lacey are said to be based on.
But I gather that the real officers took issue with Cagney and Lacey in the way that these police officers, women, pair of police officers were being depicted on television.
Absolutely. You know, that it's just continuing that long history of real people actually in these roles, not really appreciating their fictional depiction. You know, they again said that the role seemed a little bit more glamorous on TV than it actually was. And
the work. But yes. Didn't they say that they actually in real life dressed better
yes,
than the ones on TV?
Yes, they said they dressed better, but right. That's right. Yeah. They said that they looked a lot nicer than Cagney and Lacey did. But the work that Cagney and Lacey did was a lot more flashy than their day-to-day job, which does include a lot of paperwork. And, you know, some of that patient drudgery that Mary Sullivan mentions of actually being a detective. So women do, you know, kind of achieve equality with these male officers. They still face a lot of roadblocks to even being allowed onto the force. You know, as these equal rights laws are passed, women are finding that some of these police forces are then instituting height and weight measurements and, that are taller than the average woman, more than the average woman weighs. Because there's constant argument that the reason women can't be police officers is because they're not physically strong enough.
Right.
Even though women prove themselves over and over again to be able to do the job with no trouble. There's actually a police chief in Washington, D.C. who decides to kind of basically put this idea to the test. And so he hires this group, the Police Foundation, to basically watch the male and female officers for a year and, you know, just take notes on what they're doing and how well they do their job. And they actually stop the study just a couple of months in because they're like, the women are doing just fine. Like, the biggest problem for them is that men are trying to stand in their way. And so that
male police officers.
Yes. And that, you know, they're sometimes being given different instructions or, you know, told to file something rather than do the job they were actually hired to do. But that women have proven themselves over and over again to be just as physically capable of doing this job.
So are we going to lose this genre of women's, you know, detective and police fiction if everything evens out?
Well, I think we, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your perspective, I guess, I think we have a long way to go. You know, I think if you read mystery novels and watch detective stories on TV, you would think that there's a female officer in every police station
right,
in the country.
Sure.
But, you know, 15% of homicide detectives are women. The national average of police women is 13%. So the numbers are still very low. You know, they were predicting 50-50 male-female police officers in the 1980s. We're nowhere near there. So I think that this friction, we're safe for quite some time in fiction.
And what direction do you think fiction is going to take now after 175 years of lady detectives in fact and fiction?
Well, I think one of the things that we haven't really seen, at least maybe in a TV role, is that we haven't seen kind of the female Columbo in a way. You know, we see women that are part of – I'm not saying I want just
blind
a female
in one
Columbo,
eye.
But
no.
I just mean in the sense that we see women being powerful and competent detectives as part of a force, but we haven't really seen kind of the sole female professional in a television role. And so that's, I think, something that's so ground that still needs to be covered.
And I wonder what she would be doing that would be different from Columbo than anything. I mean,
I don't really know. You know,
he wasn't exactly nurturing. I mean, isn't there still that potential though that a female detective or female police officer, perhaps more than a male, if you get particularly into a domestic situation or a situation involving children, would in fact, arguably, let's say, be more effective than a male police officer still after all this time?
I think that is true. There are studies showing that female officers are less likely to use force, that interactions with a female officer are less likely to result in violence, and even that the public feels more comfortable around a female officer than they do a male officer. So I do think that there is this yes, that women do handle situations very differently. So I do think that, you know, if we ever had this female Columbo type figure, I think it would be a very different situation.
All right. We'll be watching. We'll be listening. Thank you, Erica Janik.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air.